The graphic that appears in your study guide points out the growth of the nation, starting with the promise from God to Abraham, I will make of you a great nation. And we have Act 1, Scene 1, 12 steps to a great nation. And then yesterday we were in that terrible Scene 2. Scene 2 begins with the split of the two nations, the North and the South, Israel and Judah, and the decline. First the split, then step two, the Assyrian army comes down, destroys the North, invades the South. And then step three, the South persists in resisting God. The Babylonians come, they empty the land, they take the Jews back up into Babylon. Some of the really smart Jews are up in the palace taking a university course, getting ready for being rulers like Daniel and Azariah, Mishael and Azariah and those fellows. Well, we know them, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But most of the people were down by a canal that linked the Tigris and Euphrates River called the Chebar, and the River Chebar. And the pastor there in that labor camp was, we know him as Ezekiel. So for 70 years, the people are in captivity. The land is empty. It's a mess. But we have some happier thoughts today. I found that last scene a grim and depressing time, like the book of Judges, but in some ways even worse. Complicated time, too. 39 kings between the North and the South. Only four of them walked honestly and openly before God. And then there were four others you say were pretty good kings. The people followed the detestable and vile gods and goddesses of the people around them. And the people despised the Lord in His ways. And that must really hurt. They despised the Lord. They despised the good things. And, well, there's some bright spots. There's Elijah and Elisha and Jehoshaphat and Jehoiada and a few others. But mostly this is a grim scene. Actually, the brightest thing that you see during this time, when the people are following these vile and detestable gods and these awful practices and they despise the Lord in His house, the most wonderful thing is God Himself, His patience. Again and again, early in the morning, He rises up. He is seeking His people. He's searching for them. He gives them opportunities. He sends them good kings to have revivals like Hezekiah and Josiah. And so He's really, the Lord's the hero of this time. Well, the people go into captivity. And when you think of the situation, well, Judah's defeated, looted, destroyed by Babylon. And listen to the situation. Listen to what the people lost with this captivity. The glory of God had departed from the temple, vividly described by Ezekiel. The temple was a heap of ruins. Jerusalem was like a plowed field, or in another case, like a dish that had been wiped and turned upside down. The promised land is emptied. There is no nation, there's no nation, let alone a great nation. And God's people live in exile in Babylon. By the rivers of Babylon, we sat and wept. It's as if they didn't really understand what they had until they lost it. And then when they are separated from the temple, which they despised, and the opportunity for sacrifices, which they despised, and to worship the Lord, whom they despised, when they're in Babylon, they suddenly understand what they've lost. By the rivers of Babylon, we sat and wept. We're going to be talking later about some of the things that God is doing in the captivity. But one thing He did was He cured the Jews forever of that kind of idolatry. When they came back to the land, well, at the time of Jesus, He didn't have to go around and get rid of the idols. They had lots of other problems. They became self-righteous religious people who were pretty hard to live with, but there was never again this worshiping of these idols. The moral of the story It's all too clear that we can rely on what God says He will do. God says it, He does it. To Solomon, He said, I'll tear the kingdom from you. And at Shechem, the Israelites say, to your tents, O Israel. And only Judah and Benjamin remain loyal. To Jeroboam, the Lord said, I will strike and uproot Israel from this land. And in 2 Kings 17, we read about the king of Assyria invading and deporting the Israelites to Assyria. To Judah, he said, I'll wipe Jerusalem like a dish. And in 2 Kings 25, Babylon set fire to the temple and burned the city. Another moral, in a sense, that in the midst of this mess, the Lord is still gracious and kind. And it's comfort to hear what He said through the prophet Jeremiah. I will. We were just talking about I wills. God says, I will. You can count on it. We just saw three terrible I wills. But in Jeremiah 29, He says, I will bring you back to this place. I have plans for you to give you hope and a future. I will bring you back from captivity, back to the place from which I carried you into exile. So it's not at all surprising, in light of Jeremiah 29, and especially in light of specific prophecies about Cyrus in Isaiah 44 and 45, to read in the book of Ezra that to fulfill the word spoken by Jeremiah, the Lord moved in the heart of Cyrus to make a proclamation. Cyrus, the king of the Persians, makes a proclamation. The Lord, he said, the God of heaven, has appointed me to build a temple for Him at Jerusalem. There must have been some stunned silence. And then all of a sudden, people looking at one another and saying, we're going home. We're going home. Of course, a generation has passed away, but we're going home at last. Well, scene three starts with going home. Steps one and two. I want to give you an overview of steps one, two, and three. There are four steps in scene three, but I want to give you overview of the first three steps. They're Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. We're going to call them the twins and the orphan. The twins and the orphan. Why do you call them twins and the orphan? Well, the outline of Ezra and Nehemiah is same. Not identical twins, fraternal twins, but for example, Ezra is organized chapter 1 to 6 and then chapter 7 to 10. Nehemiah is organized chapter 1, 6 and then 7 to 13. But Esther the orphan, why, it just starts at chapter 1 and wanders its way down to chapter 10. It just isn't divided in that way. And then as far as content, in chapter 1 to 6 of Ezra and chapter 1 to 6 of Nehemiah, there is similar content in the two. The content in Ezra 1 to 6 and Nehemiah 1 to 6 is similar. And in 7 to 10 in Ezra and 7 to 13 in Nehemiah, the content is similar. But the content in chapter 1 through 10 of Esther isn't anything at all like the content in either the first part or the second part of the twins, Ezra and Nehemiah. Ezra and Nehemiah are both at work in Jerusalem. They're in Jerusalem, not Esther. She's up in Susa in Persia, and she's not going to get anywhere near Jerusalem. Jerusalem's not mentioned. And then central character. In Ezra, over and over again, the hand of the Lord was upon us. In Nehemiah, over and over, the hand of the Lord was upon us. In Esther, God is not mentioned either by name or referred to indirectly at all in the whole book. So we'll get back to Esther later. She's a bit of an orphan. That's a different kind of book. And we'll look first at Ezra and Nehemiah. But let's recognize that there are people ready to return to the land, and it's a time of rejoicing. You remember Psalm 137. We sat down and wept. How can we sing the Lord's song? But listen to Psalm 126. These are people excited about coming back. When the Lord brought back the captives to Zion, we were like men who dreamed. Our mouths were filled with laughter, our tongues with songs of joy. Then it was said among the nations, the Lord has done great things for them. The Lord has done great things for us, and we are filled with joy. Restore our fortunes, O Lord, like streams in the Negev. Those who sow in tears will reap with songs of joy. He who goes out weeping, carrying seeds to sow, will return with songs of joy, carrying sheaves with him. Well, we want to talk about those who came back, but we will first want to mention and reiterate what they're coming back to. They're coming back to a place that was so precious. Remember in an earlier session, we said it's hard for New Testament Christians to understand the importance in that Old Testament system, the importance of the specific place. Deuteronomy 12, you shall seek the Lord at the place which the Lord chooses. And you'll go there to offer on the altar the blood of your sacrifices to the place the Lord chooses. 1 Kings chapter 12, the dedication of the temple. This idea occurs over and over. The glory of the Lord filled the temple. And God's eyes are open towards this place. God's name's going to be there. People pray towards this place. When people are having dispute, they come to this temple. When defeated because they've sinned, they make supplication at the temple. They pray towards this place. They can come here for confession and repentance. Foreigners come to this house that bears God's name. When there's war, you pray towards this temple. Sin, towards this temple. This is the temple, the land, and the city that was chosen by the Lord and built for His name. You remember Psalm 137? How can we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? How can we? They say, sing us songs of Zion. How can we? I used to interpret that as, well, they were really down. I mean, you can ask a guy to get up and sing this song when he's just feeling terrible, feeling rotten. But I think perhaps there's more to it. I think they were saying, in effect, how can we sing the songs of the Lord in a foreign land? Because they belong back there. They belong in Jerusalem. They belong at the temple. They belong at the place of sacrifice. Those songs don't fit. You just don't go out. It's kind of like some movie stars who decided that they would sing religious songs, and they used to go to nightclubs and things like This Little Light of Mine. But in the midst of horrible situations, they would sing these little children's choruses that I guess some of them remembered when they were children. It didn't fit very well. The nightclub act never really got off the ground with them singing, the wise man built his house upon the rock. They're in these nightclubs. They're saying, how can we sing the Lord's song? How can we do it in a foreign land? In John chapter 4, Jesus is having a conversation with a Samaritan woman. You remember the Samaritans were people who had moved into the land by the Assyrians. They were kind of mixed people. And she says to Jesus, you Jews claim that the place where we must worship is in Jerusalem. That's what you Jews say. And Jesus didn't say, no, ma'am, you've got it wrong. He just said, well, that may be the way it is now, but believe me, woman, a time is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain, that is in Samaria, or in Jerusalem. But at that time, in the Old Testament system, it was a place. Well, the people are coming back, and we want to take a look at the twins, Ezra and Nehemiah. Ezra 1-6, Ezra comes back, and his duty is to rebuild the temple. And so he leads the people back, and they really get to it. The 50,000 of them that returned, actually is a fraction under 50,000, and they are numbered for us in Ezra. And there are names of these people and what families they're from. 50,000 of them came back. That's great, isn't it? Although 50,000 isn't many. I mean, to people, repeople a nation. So 50,000 returned. And from this point on, it's taken for granted that all Israel is back. The 12 tribes are spoken of both here and also in the New Testament. There are sacrifices for each of the tribes. Some people talk about the 10 lost tribes of Israel. Well, first of all, when Israel and Judah split into two, many people from the north came south because they didn't want to be separated from the temple. Even though Jeroboam built altars at Dan and Bethel, they came and there was a people that came down. Later, during the revivals of Josiah, people from the north came down. And it's clear that when the people came back from Babylon, some of those who came back from Babylon were from the families of those who had originally gone into captivity under the Assyrians. So we're back. We've got one nation. Well, I'll talk more about it. It's not really a nation. They're not a nation yet. But they rebuild in 1 year the altar. And then there's a 20-year delay. They just don't get down to getting the temple built. And that's where God brings some prophets in. Haggai and Zechariah come. They start telling the people what they have to do. And so after a 20-year lapse, they get back to work and they rebuild the temple. And when they finish the temple, they rejoice and they weep. Well, they rejoice because they've rebuilt the temple, the place. We can sing the songs of Zion here, but they wept because it just wasn't the same. Actually, the new temple was bigger than the old temple, but it was kind of bigger the way a Walmart is bigger than the Taj Mahal, you know. I mean, it wasn't the wonder of the world. And not only that, conspicuously missing was the glory of the Lord, which did not fill that place. Actually, one day the glory of the Lord is going to appear suddenly in the temple in the form of the young Jesus. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Nehemiah followed Ezra. And he too led people back to the land under the authority of the king of Persia. And he came to build a wall. Say, build a wall. What's the big deal about building a wall? Well, a city without a wall was not much of a city and was so vulnerable to everybody around. And so it wasn't an ornamental wall. Won't this look nice? It was a wall to establish, protect, and preserve Jerusalem, to give stability to it. And he too has lots of opposition, lots of trouble. But finally, the people band together and the wall is completed with the help. The hand of God was upon them. My father and uncle were Seabees during the World War II. And the Seabees were craftsmen. They were working men who, tradesmen who were in the military. And they go out and build airstrips and things like that right in the front lines. And they had their symbol was a bee. And the bee had a gun in one hand and a tool in the other. And that's exactly what happened back in the building of the wall, because there were so many enemies. These Samaritans didn't want the wall rebuilt. And so there they were protecting themselves with weapons with one hand while rebuilding the wall. So Ezra, step one, rebuild the altar and the temple. Nehemiah, step two, rebuild the wall. In Ezra 7 to 10, he turns from rebuilding the altar in the temple to rebuilding the way of life. Do you remember the law of God, which was meant to be a way of life? The people weren't to live the way they lived in Egypt, nor the way they lived in Canaan. But here was the way God called people to live. Well, that had been long lost. That had faded out. And so Ezra comes back and he leads reforms, where in Ezra chapter 7 to 10, they go back. He reads a letter from the king. He reminisces about what God has done in the past and faithful men. And then he speaks to them on a particular issue. He speaks to them about the problem of intermarrying with the women of the area. And then he leads them in a time of confession and repentance. Nehemiah comes along later. He actually has a guest appearance by Ezra in the book. And starting in chapter 7 of Nehemiah, he has a reading, a public reading of the law, and a confession of sin, and a dedication of the wall, And then he preaches a sermon in which he gets down to three things. Tobiah's room, one of the enemies who had tried to keep the wall from being rebuilt. He's got his own private room in God's temple. Get him out of here. And then they were not given the Levites the pay that they were supposed to get. And thirdly, they were desecrating the Sabbath, just turning it into a big market day. And then, of course, you remember his fourth topic, and that was intermarriage. And he preached a stern sermon. He said, even Solomon in all his glory was caused to sin by these foreign women. So that's Ezra, step one, rebuilding the temple and the altar, and then rebuilding the law. Nehemiah, step two, rebuilding the wall, and then rebuilding the law. I think we can learn a lot if we look at the prayer, Ezra's prayer in chapter 9. It's a prayer about, here we go again, intermarriage. We read in chapter 9 that hearing that the people of Israel, including the priests and the Levites, had intermarried with foreign women, Ezra is deeply grieved. And he says, I tore my tunic and cloak when I heard this, and I pulled the hair from my head and beard, and I sat down appalled. Actually, he pulled his hair and beard out. I think Nehemiah did him one better, maybe more effective. He tore the people's hair out. If you're going to tear somebody's hair out, it's probably better to start with the guy that's the culprit. Oh, but think of Ezra just tearing his hair out, literally, and sits down. He's just appalled. And then he starts pleading with God. He says, oh, God, I'm so ashamed and disgraced to lift my face to you. From the days of our forefather until now, our guilt has been great. We are a people of guilt and shame. He said, oh, but you have been so good, Lord. You've been gracious in leaving us a remnant and giving us a firm place in his sanctuary. Lord, shown kindness in the sight of the kings of Persia. He's granted us new life to rebuild the house of our God and to repair its ruins. God has been so good to us. And now, what can I say, Lord? For we're disregarding the commands you gave through your servants, the prophets. When he talked about the land being polluted by the corruptions of its people, by its detestable practices, and they filled it with impurity from one end to the other. Therefore, the Lord said, do not give your daughters in marriage to their sons or take their daughters for your sons. There's shame. There had been shameful disobedience on this in the past. And now it's happening again. Remember, the problem wasn't that these women were ethnically different. That was not the problem. Remember Rahab, remember Ruth, the Moabitess. No, it's that they worship false gods. And so Ezra says, shall we again break your commands and intermarry with the people who commit such detestable practice? Would you not be angry enough with us to destroy us, leaving us no remnant? You left us a remnant before. Oh, Lord God of Israel, you're righteous. We are left this day as a remnant. Not one of us can stand in your presence. Boy, quite a prayer, isn't it? Remnant. Well, you know, he'd said that God had been gracious originally in leaving a remnant. And he says then, you have punished us less than our sins have deserved, and you have given us a remnant. And he said, boy, Lord, are you going to destroy us and leave no remnant? We are left this day as a remnant. The question is, what in the world's a remnant? Well, you know, they have these remnant stores, cloth and carpet. You know what the remnant is? What's a remnant? What is the remnant? It's kind of the leftovers after the factory has sold a bunch of carpet. They've got some bits of carpet rolled up and they sell it as remnant. I'm not sure if that's true. I think maybe they actually cut it originally as sell it as remnants so people think they're getting a bargain. But anyway, remnants, the leftovers, the bits that are left over. What is a remnant? The leftovers. Question, if the 50,000 who returned were the remnant, those who rejoiced and went back to the land, Where are the vast majority of the Jews? And the answer is that the vast majority of the Jews are still outside the land, scattered throughout the 127 provinces of the Persian Empire, and facing threats of extinction and destruction. Wow. Lord, you've left us a remnant. The remnant return. The majority are still out there. At the time of Jesus, there were more Jews living outside the land by far than there were Jews in Palestine. And these Jews did two things. They tried to survive, and some of those Jews of good heart funded the return. If you read in Ezra chapter 2, they took up offerings and they raised money. Reminds me of the return to Israel in the late 1940s and the early 1950s, when American Jewry raised money all over the place, had big fundraising banquets with well-known Jewish entertainers who would actually point to people in the crowd and have them stand up and publicly say how much they were going to give for the return to, for supporting the return to Israel. And the American Jews supported the European Jewish return to the land. Well, generations and generations earlier, it was those Jews living out in the provinces of Persia who supported the return of the remnant, the remnant. So if you can keep that in mind. Now, this is a bright spot. Ezra and Nehemiah, the twins, rebuild the altar and the temple, that place, rebuild the wall of Jerusalem, reestablish Jerusalem, rebuild the law, rebuild the law, rebuild the way of life. But I like to point out that while they've moved back and there is a remnant, these people are not fully a nation. From the time of the return under the Persians, and later serving under the Greeks, and then serving under the Romans, the Jews were, till their destruction in the year 70 AD under the Romans, they were, all through that time, a colony. They were under the control of these great world powers, except for a few brief years in the period between the Old and New Testament when the Maccabees wrestled a little degree of independence. So the Jews at one time, the Jewish religious leaders said to Jesus, you know, well, we're our father is Abraham. We've never been ruled by anybody. Oh, no, that's not the case. The remnant that's returned to the land is not a great nation. It's a struggling colony, barely holding on to their distinctives as a people. Well, we've had the twins. The next session, we're going to take a look at the orphan.